Something coming faster than any of us can imagine and will change our lives in the most dramatic ways is AI.
And while AI used to sound freaky to me and just something that was going to take over my world, it really would have revolutionized my practice had I stuck around. Many of you know, I got so burnt out from charting. It was the big reason I left medicine because I was frustrated with the EMRs, the clunkiness, and the amount of time it took to learn them. Not only that, but not being able to sit and connect with a patient and look them in the eye, like one-on-one while you're actually interacting with them, the whole reason we went into medicine, not to do paperwork.
Yeah, so that's why May and I have started working with Lindy.ai, which is fascinating. They help you produce the most efficient notes, fully customizable, which is different than some other AI products, so you can do what you do best, which is see patients and let the artificial intelligence scribe do the dirty work for you.
Yeah, not only do you get the perfect patient notes the way you want, written in any format, for whatever specialty you're in, and maybe you're in ophthalmology or vet medicine, it will also create the note, scribe and send the patient follow-up instructions, referral letters, consultation notes. It's amazing. Lindy is offering our listeners a 7-day trial to experience the difference of their AI medical scribe. Go sign up at lindy.ai/bsfree to get started. That is Lindy, lindy.ai/bsfree.
Finally, a source of raw, real, and honest information on healthcare issues that matter most. Welcome to BS Free MD. From the latest medical information to how to stay sane as a doctor or a patient, no subject is taboo, and no BS is allowed. Now, let's welcome your hosts, Drs. May and Tim Hindmarsh.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of BS Free MD podcast. And today we are thrilled to have with us investigative journalist and true crime author John Leake joining us. John has a fascinating background with a lifelong passion for medical history and forensic medicine. And he's here to talk about not only his latest gripping book, The Meaning of Malice, which dives into the dark corners of a suspected serial killer in Dallas, Texas. Sheds light on some forensic evidence there as well, but he is also known for his collaborative work with Dr. Peter McCullough, who's been on our show multiple times, and for their work on The Courage to Face COVID-19. It's a critical look at the early treatment of COVID-19 and the battle against the biopharmaceutical complex. So get ready for a great show. Welcome, John, to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We are super excited to have you here. I know Tim's a big fan of your Substack as well. I know that, man, I think we're going to just dive right in to find out a little bit about The Courage to Face COVID-19. And how did you get connected with Peter in that and writing that first off?
I do have a long-standing interest in forensic medicine. As a true crime author, I have worked with forensic pathologists and people in crime labs examining forensic evidence. And for a while, when I lived in Vienna, Austria, I actually did some translation work for a pathologist at the Vienna Institute of Forensic Medicine. And so I had long become adept at reading medical literature, and I kind of became fascinated by medical history, particularly the issue of how we die. What exactly do forensic pathologists look for? Signs of foul play. And then, you know, on a broader macro level, this concept of expected or unexpected death. You know, why are people suddenly and unexpectedly dying? This really is the prime. You know, we think of a coroner or a medical examiner as someone kind of a Sherlock Holmes guy who's looking for stab wounds or something like that, or strangulation marks on the neck. But a lot of what they do is they just monitor the population looking for signals that people are dying unexpectedly. And then they investigate, well, you know, what would cause that? So that was kind of my interpretive framework. When I heard the first reports of COVID-19 coming out of Wuhan, China, I read the WHO bulletin from their office in China, you know, a flu-like illness has been detected circulating in this province. And then, so I started following that. I was very interested in the history of the 1918 Spanish flu. Again, living in Vienna, one of my favorite artists was a young guy named Egon Schiele, and young artist in Vienna. He was in his late 20s in 1918. In October of 1918, both he and his young wife were stricken with Spanish flu, and he painted a very poignant portrait of her on her deathbed. And then he himself died 2 days later. And so I was very interested in the literature of the Spanish flu. And so when I started seeing all of this talk about COVID-19, I started paying very close attention. And I began to suspect that for various reasons that what we were being told just, you know, you study enough fraud, and as a true crime reporter, I've studied a lot of it. You just start to kind of, it's called pattern recognition, kind of know when people are lying. And so I thought, you know, a lot of what we're being told just doesn't add up. I was living in Dallas, Texas at the time. It's where I grew up. And so I was at home in Dallas when these reports start coming out of first China and then Italy. And I thought, you know, I want to look into this. I think something fishy is going on here. But I knew I needed a medical expert to help me to interpret this, to you know, make sense of this from a trained medical professional standpoint. But it was a funny thing because I knew, okay, he's going to have to be pretty top guy with real academic credentials. Obviously, it would be great if he's also a practicing physician, like actually see patients. But there was one other criterion that he had to meet, my theoretical medical expert. He had to also be questioning what we were being told. So I was kind of looking for a unicorn. And I didn't know, you know, where am I going to find this guy? And anyway, long story short, turns out this guy, Peter McCullough, lives a mile away from me in Dallas. So I sent an email to his secretary, and I said, I'd like to interview Dr. McCullough. Dr. McCullough was very gracious. He met me at a studio right near his former hospital, and we had this great interview. I'm beautifully shot in studio. I posted it on YouTube and multiple channels. It almost instantly went viral, but YouTube took it down after about 3 hours. So, I mean, it stayed up on Rumble and Vimeo, and I think Blaze Media picked it up. Salem Media picked it up. I think it was, over time, has gotten over 100 million views in aggregate, chopped up on all these different platforms. But YouTube took it down in 3 hours. And that was my first real personal realization that we are being censored. I mean, I've watched YouTube, you know, for 20 years. It's my favorite video platform. I mean, I was a YouTube fan before anybody. And I realized if YouTube's censoring this, we're in trouble. So Peter and I, Dr. McCullough and I, started working together. He actually proposed that we write a book together, and he was interested in my work as a true crime author. We agreed that what we're looking at has all of the hallmarks of organized crime. So my concept for the book is, this is going to be a work of true crime. It's going to be delineating, exposing an organized criminal conspiracy. My concept for Dr. McCullough is he could be like a chief expert medical witness. So if you were to imagine us serving as witnesses for a prosecution, you know, I would present the basic circumstances of the case, and then Dr. McCullough, you know, would present some of the hard medical data and analysis. And so that's how we wrote the book. And it's been a real success. People have really responded well. Now, it was up on Amazon for 18 months, and then quite suddenly last September, Amazon decided to ban it. And that was quite a fun moment, because Amazon should not have given me any details in its email. You know, when you start doing nefarious stuff, right, you know, it's best to kind of not be very communicative. So they made the mistake of saying in their email, the reasons why we ban this is because it violates the offensive content clause of our community standards. So I thought, okay, they've hanged themselves with that, because their offensive content clause, it's very specific. It's like inciting violence, inciting terrorism, glorifying rape, murder, all this kind of stuff. I mean, our book doesn't even touch on any of these. I mean, the word sex, violence, rape, murder, whatever, it's not even mentioned in the book. So we really protested hard and had some First Amendment people to support us. And so Amazon backed off, and they reinstated the book. So anyway, that's to say, it's been a real adventure.
Wow.
Well, it just reminds me, you know, of what RFK Jr. has been saying from the rooftops now for, you know, the last going on 2 years, which is the censors are never the good guys. You know, you know, obviously you're a historian. Look, you know, look at history. They're always on the wrong side of history.
Always.
And yet they're doubling and tripling and quadrupling down. Like, even our, you know, podcast has been, you know, we've had episodes taken down, of course, coincidentally with Peter. And then we had one episode, one of our DocTales episodes, where we're having a couple drinks, and I was ranting about a study about, you know, The Thing and about other things that start with V. And it was just, and YouTube, it wasn't just, it was, if you go against any vaccine that's approved, we'll take you down. Like, they just came out and said it. It wasn't if you tell people that, you know, misinformation or whatever. It was very specific. And I was like, wow, that is super ballsy now.
Yeah. And, you know, what I find so fascinating about censorship today is, you know, historically, a society that is very interested in maintaining the innocence of children. Of children and adolescents, a concept that children are innocent, their lives should not be intruded on at an early age with adult themes of sexuality. And, you know, adults will be able to contend with that for the rest of their lives. Let's leave the kids out of it until they get older, until they reach the threshold of adulthood. So, you know, censors would say, you know, we don't want obscene material being presented to children or readily accessible to children. You know, now we've flipped it on its head, where guys like, you know, Dr. McCullough talking about treating patients with repurposed FDA-approved drugs, that is deemed worthy of censorship. But the aggressive dissemination of sexual matters to children is endorsed. I mean, this whole transgender thing of a 14 or a 15-year-old thinking about, you know, I need to be surgically transformed from a little girl to a boy. I mean, it's complete madness, but that is not censored, whereas a medical doctor with 650 peer-reviewed publications in the medical literature can't talk about prescribing ivermectin. I mean, and you know, the thing that I'm increasingly telling people is yes, I want to emphasize this. I am a conspiracy theorist. I propound conspiracy theories every single day about what's going on, and they are all, I'm batting 400. They are all proven true, emerging evidence every day. And why is that? Because our government agencies and our corporatist structure of economy and government and the way our constitution is being subverted, the way the mainstream or the legacy media is has become propaganda organs of these major interests, they are conspiring all the time. Just constant fraud. And it's not even difficult to detect. I mean,
no.
I mean, I'll just say one last thing on this and shut up. I mean, so I spent a lot of time in Europe, and I lived in Vienna, Austria, but I spent a lot of time in Germany. And March of 2020, you know, I was paying attention to Germany. And a lot of what the German government is saying, it just doesn't add up. This whole business of people wearing a dirty mask and putting it on before they go in the grocery store. I mean, just a lot of this just looks like patent BS. And I thought, you know, I bet the Robert Koch Institute is being, you know, if true science is being done in the Robert Koch Institute, the political establishment is either distorting it or ignoring it. I mean, I just had this hunch. And then just a couple of weeks ago, a German independent news magazine called Multipolar did a Germany's equivalent of a Freedom of Information Act, and they get the minutes of the pandemic crisis, protocols of their deliberations at the Robert Koch Institute in March of 2020. And there it is. The name is redacted. An external actor is telling the scientist at the Institute, you know, what they need to say. I mean, it's actually explicitly stated that the Robert Koch Institute is going to have to toe the line on political policy. And so, I mean, anyway, it's just amazing to me how much fraud we've seen in the last 4 years.
But here is like the irony of all ironies. First of all, you know, Koch's postulates are, you know, the foundation of, you know, virology and bacteriology, right?
Bacteriology, I would say.
You know, you have to like find the age. You have to find the agent. You have to infect the human or the, you know, experimental animal, and then you have to recover it again from the animal. You know, there you go, and then reculture the bacteria to prove that that was the causative agent. Okay, so like this is the hardest science at the, you know, dawn of germ theory. Okay, so these guys can't get it right, and they're co-opted by the government. And then, oh yeah, nothing's ever happened in Germany bad when scientists were co-opted by the government. Like that nothing bad ever happened, you know? Like,
well, I mean, to be clear here, I mean, what, and look, there's so many redactions and there's thousands of pages. It'll have to be thoroughly examined. But the picture that's emerged so far is, there actually were good scientists, and they were saying, you know, it's not clear that masking and locking people up and all of this, it's going to be efficacious. I mean, the virus is out. It's beyond the containment phase. Like, we're stuck with this thing. And moreover, we're not seeing evidence that it is poses such a lethal risk to the entire population. So the point there is that there were scientists that were offering an honest assessment, but it's not what the public policy guys wanted to hear.
Right. Well, and Scott Atlas said the exact same thing. He said the first meeting he had with Birx and Fauci, you know, he had a tome of information. He's like, let's look at the data. Like we've gone through this long enough now. There's real good information, you know, information on whether we should open schools and whether masks work and all this. And it was just, they didn't want to look at a single piece of data. They had their minds made up, and it was just, let's get together and figure out how we're going to message this so people keep doing what they're told.
I mean, right.
It was wild to even comprehend that.
Right.
So I, speaking of, now, do you have a theory? Like, is this money? Is it control? Is it all of the above? I mean, I try to give the powers that be, you know, the benefit of the doubt, you know, that the kind of that postulate of don't assume malice when incompetence will do. And Scott Atlas, when you listen to him, tends to go down that road. He goes, these guys were just not great scientists, and they were bureaucrats for whatever. And they were great bureaucrats and terrible at actual science. So they just kind of fumble farted their way through this. Yet at the same time, when the same thing is happening in Germany and Italy and the United States and China and all of these countries, it's hard to believe they're just all simultaneously dumb.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that seemed very well planned and very well executed, I mean, executed with astonishing uniformity and efficiency, was the absolute 100% preference for the vaccine solution. So, you know, if you look at pandemic preparation, you know, going back 20 years, I mean, at least as early as first SARS in 2002, 2003, you know, there were always discussions of two different approaches to a hypothetical pandemic. The early treatment approach and the vaccine approach. And, you know, the deliberations that you see in these pandemic seminars, it's like, well, for the people who are getting sick straight away, I mean, they're getting sick way before we have a chance to develop a vaccine. So, like, first and foremost, first line of response is we're going to have to try and find something to help people. I mean, it may not be a right. silver bullet, but, you know, something to reduce the severity of it. And then, you know, the other kind of second line of response was develop a vaccine as quickly as we can. But it was always understood that you were going to have to kind of look at both of these. By the time you get to the year 2016, the Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum, they started a new institution. They announced it, I believe, in January of 2017 at the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos. They said, you know, we're pleased to announce the founding of CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovations. And CEPI is a new institution that is going to be 100% dedicated to the rapid development of vaccine solutions to emerging infectious diseases. And they published a business plan. You can read it. It's online. CEPI's preliminary business plan. It's illustrated with a hypodermic needle going into a deltoid muscle. And the whole business plan, the entire thing, it doesn't even mention the word treatment. Right? I don't think treatment is mentioned once in the entire 65-page document. It's only the vaccine solution. And I think at the same time you have CEPI, you have this increasing interest in this idea of we're gonna find a new generation of vaccine technology that is not dependent on this culturing of vaccines and poultry eggs. Like this whole flu vaccine culture method, it's, you know, it goes back to the 50s. Like, we need to come up with a new generation of vaccine technology where you could quickly ascertain the gene sequence of the virus and rapidly, like within a month, come up with a genetic sequence that you could incorporate or put into a gene therapy, a gene transfer shot that would induce the body to produce some iteration of this gene sequence. And so it's this kind of high-tech Star Trek idea. And that's what we want to do. And so this gene transfer technology was kind of on the shelves of laboratories. They just needed a pandemic to unveil it and to put it to work. So it looks like there's this complex, we call it the biopharmaceutical complex, and they were poised for their 100% vaccine solution and a genetic vaccine solution. And when SARS-CoV-2 came out of the lab, it gave them the moment they'd been waiting for.
Well, which was interesting because just in the last couple of days, the NIH has gone to BioNTech and ask for royalty payments. So what that means is, for people that haven't been, you know, as deep in the weeds as we have in this, it means that the mRNA technology came from our government and was then distributed to both BioNTech, which then went to Pfizer, and also to Moderna, that also had been paying royalty payments to NIH. And here's the part that's just delicious. You get a royalty payment as an individual scientist in the NIH, and you don't have to disclose how much it is. That just, like, it's like the insider trading stuff in Congress. Like, you can't, it's so unbelievably corrupt. It's like, how does that exist?
Yes. So that's that. So my understanding is that original Moderna vaccine that Anthony Fauci announced, the prototype that he announced, I think it was on March the 20th, very, very quickly after the first patient in the United States was ascertained, Fauci in the NIAID issues a press release saying, you know, we're pleased to announce we've got this prototypical messenger RNA vaccine that we've developed with Moderna in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so that initial program was a joint NIAID Moderna product. And, you know, and Fauci, who is, you know, the face of the pandemic response, I mean, he actually has an interest in the vaccine solution. I mean, his institution, and possibly he himself, apparently has an economic benefit from the vaccine solution. So, you know, all of this is really out in the open. It's very clear. There's a huge paper trail of all of it. These guys don't even really bother, concealing their tracks. But for some reason, our legacy media and a lot of our people are very slow to awaken to this.
Well, there was a wonderful, we've had it on our show, there was a wonderful post done by the Canadian COVID Coalition folks, and it was just called Brought to You by Pfizer. And it's like 2 minutes long, and it's just all of the news shows that are sponsored by Pfizer, not by a particular drug, just by the company. You know, The Royal Wedding, brought to you by Pfizer. Wake Up America, brought to you by Pfizer. This afternoon with whoever, brought to you by, I mean, it was fascinating. So you sit there and you go, okay, it makes sense. Why is the legacy media not saying anything? Well, because they're bought. They purchased them. You know, it's perfect. I mean, and in a way, like, you sit there and you scratch your head and you go, I mean, this is the coalescence of government and, you know, government regulators and giant corporations in bed together. We have a name for that. I mean, that's fascism, plain and simple.
Yeah. I concur. I mean, you know, Pfizer has been so utterly fanatical in its marketing. I mean, and its whole marketing endeavor, I think they're now spending way more money on marketing initiatives than they are on drug development. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is that, you know, I think so much of the low hanging fruit of illnesses that can be unmet, large, you know, widespread illnesses afflicting the human population, that for which a pharmaceutical molecule will really be safe and effective. I think the low-hanging fruit, you know, has been harvested. It just becomes harder and harder to find a safe and effective molecule to treat an unmet condition. It's just really, really hard. And so I think Pfizer's just gotten in the habit of, like, let's look for that occasional windfall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where is it? When? And then if we find a winner, put just an unholy amount of marketing firepower behind it. You know, I have personal experience with Pfizer. I was educated on Pfizer stock when I was born. My great grandmother gifted me a pretty good chunk of Pfizer stock. And so I have to be grateful to Charles Pfizer. I mean, she was an admirer of Pfizer's work in developing penicillin during the Second World War. So, you know, that kind of paid for my education. I still had a big chunk of Pfizer stock in 1998 when they released Viagra. And, you know, Viagra was originally conceived for treating cardiovascular illnesses, you know, heart problems. But they discovered in the trials that, well, we don't really know that it's helping these guys' hearts, but it's having a salutary effect, you know, on another region of the body. And so they quickly repurposed it, not as a heart drug, an angina drug, but as a what is that marvelous
ED?
erectile dysfunction. Yeah. That used to be called impotence. Yeah,
yes, exactly.
Because that hurts people's feelings. So they actually sent a delegation to the Vatican to obtain the blessing of John Paul II.
What?
And with the way they pitched it to the old boy was that this will preserve marriage. I guess the theory is that wives will be, you know, satisfied with their husbands or something like this. In fact, it did the opposite.
I was going to say,
you know, suddenly the old boy gets himself a new convertible and, you know, goes out, you know, cruising, young girls. So, that was a big Pfizer windfall in 1998. And it just kind of looks like, you know, they've been looking for windfalls ever since. And this whole vaccine racket, boy, I mean, the government buys all of it from you. The government does all of the marketing. The government mandates that everybody get it. And the government mandates that everybody get your boosters. I mean, it's the best business model ever.
Well, and then if it ends up being a stinker, you can't get sued.
No.
Like, if it ends up being a stinker, unlike every other product
exactly
on planet Earth, you can't be sued if it harms people. But all of this is out there. Again, I mean, you and I, you know, we're talking about it. It just seems plain as day, but it's amazing to me how well the propaganda has worked.
Well, that's what really blows my mind. Like we follow the CDC on Instagram just to post stuff once in a while, and then of course 99% of the posts that you get or the comments you get are overwhelmingly supportive, because the only people that follow the CDC are people that hate the CDC and the five, you know, Russian bots that like it or whatever. So it's these hilarious comments. But I was saying to May, it's just it's staggering. Like you pose a question. You don't even take a stand on something like this. You just say, hey, you know, I think we should think twice about what you put into your body. And people lose their mind. You can't be a real doctor. You should have your license revoked.
Oh, I'm gonna.
All I did is ask a question. I didn't even make a statement.
This is one of the weirdest things is just questioning things. Just questioning the official narrative. Just, hey, gee whiz, you know, Columbo, you know, scratch your head. This looks kind of weird to me. That's not allowed. People will, flip out. Right. I'm curious about the whole world and investigating the whole world. I think the whole world is just an endless investigation. And, I was looking at this Baltimore bridge collapse. And, you know, I've been interested in shipwrecks and I've been a sailor my whole life. And I just thought, you know, it looks like a rudder input that turned that vessel to starboard. So it was like, why? Like you, maybe they ought to investigate. Like was there a malfunction in the steering gear? Did the auxiliary power not come on? Did someone panic and input a starboard rudder input, and then when the power came back on, it engaged it when he was. I mean, there are a number of things that could explain this, but I mean, it's very, very strange to watch the video on that. It's like, what is going on? And you know, on a clear, calm, windless night, and I checked the NOAA data, it was a windless night. You just don't expect a 100,000 ton vessel to demolish an entire bridge and take out an entire port. I mean, it's like, this needs to be explained. Exactly. But you know, people just freak out and they're like, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist. And well, to which I say, yes, I am. And my theories are always proven correct.
But well, and the other thing that was unbelievably curious about that is it took about what, like 15 seconds for the federal government to come out and say it was an accident.
Yes.
Which, right. You know, which is just like, I mean,
How do they know that?
Yeah. I've given this entirely terrible metaphor numerous times, but it's just like, okay, I have a group of friends I go to Vegas with every 2 or 3 years. Okay. It's like, I come home, I'm exhausted, I drank too much, May knows all that. And she says, hey, honey, how was your trip? I said, it was great. And we never had a stripper to our room named Trixie.
Yeah, there you go. But hey, look, we didn't have any strippers in our room. And she says, well, but I didn't ask if you had. I mean,
right. Exactly. And it's like, so before there's an investigation, we know the answer. Well, I mean, come on, you know what happened.
Well, and then, you know, the other thing is, so what do we mean by an accident? I mean, there's a whole range of possibility. It's like, okay, who exactly was the pilot? Like, who is that person? When were they hired? Under what circumstances were they hired? What was their resume? I mean, one thing that, you know, that comes up is in this weird world in which diversity has become this kind of fetish. I think diversity is a fetish. It's not real diversity anyway. I mean, real diversity would be, you know, we like a diversity of competency, like a guy that's coming from this place. But diversity now means their skin color or their sex. Okay, so, you know, I was paying very I love maritime disasters. So that carbon fiber submersible that went down onto the Titanic. Did y'all remember this? It was last year. And then
we have a lot of very similar interests. Yes. I can literally watch the airline disaster show for like 8 hours.
It's fascinating. Yeah. It's just fascinating. Well, so this carbon fiber submersible, it goes down to the Titanic, and if you do the time calculation, they lost contact, you know, around the time that they could have been expected to be pretty close to the actual vessel sitting on the bottom of the Atlantic. I mean, I think it's like 13,000 feet of water, and then, you know, it all goes silent. They lose contact, and you know, so you start looking at that accident. And it turns out there was an engineer, I think he had a background in naval submarines, who had warned about that carbon fiber hole. So, okay, it was an accident, but what led to the accident? That's what we need to examine. And I feel like we're in an era where if you start digging, you will discover that poor decisions were made that may bear liability for someone. But our government seems to now be more in the business of concealment than transparency. So, I mean, this talk of, well, it was hacked by, you know, the Chinese or you know, I don't know. But what I have asked for, what I have said would be a prudent approach is figure out precisely what happened here.
Yeah. Well, and when you look at the, you know, NTSB historically and what they've done with, you know, airline crashes and train crashes, I mean, it's unbelievable how good a job these guys have done. Like that is an amazing government institution. Like, you know, like that when what was that, TWA 007 or whatever it was shot down, and they reclaimed virtually every piece of that and reassembled it inside a gigantic hangar. And you sit
there, so they don't have it for ships.
No, they're the National Transportation
Safety Bureau. No, that's mean. I mean, yes. You always hear about it with airplanes, but what about?
Yeah, that would be under their purview, I would assume.
And sure,
it's like,
I mean, we see that Pete Buddha, I don't know how to pronounce
Buddha, yeah, Buddha Judge, I guess.
I mean, you're already kind of getting shaky, in my opinion. Like, you know, if you wanna corrupt an institution, just start making highly ideological decisions in your hiring. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what comes out. But when I look at that hard turn to starboard, you know, right as it's approaching the pier, it looks very weird to me. And I've not yet heard a plausible explanation. Not even close. I mean, people have said, hey, threw it into reverse. There was a prop walk. No way. That's 100,000 ton vessel going 7.5 knots. You're not just going to throw it into reverse. You know, that's not plausible. The other thing I'll say on that is, you know, it's a slow speed marine engine. I'm not positive about this, but I think there's a high probability that prop is actually attached directly to the engine. Mm-hmm. You actually have to bring that vessel to a complete halt and then reverse the engine. It's not the transmission that's being reversed. It's the whole mechanics of the engine. I don't think we have seen a plausible explanation for this. And it looks to me like a rudder error, an erroneous rudder command or input. So anyway, we could talk about that one forever. But as you can see, the common thread is a loss of trust in our government agencies.
Yes. And so, I mean, again, you know, how do you get it back? And I think the only way you get it back is transparency. You know, it's back to the stripper comment. You know, you start with marriage counseling after that one, if you want to save your marriage. And, you know, I think the marriage counseling in this case is, you know, they need to have investigations and say, hey, look, you know, we made mistakes. A pandemic, how could you not make mistakes? People will forgive you if they know they're not being lied to. Now,
I heard Eric Weinstein. He's a physicist, and he has an investment manager. And for a while, he had his own podcast. And you know, he was talking the other day in a podcast, and he said something that really resonated with me. He said, what we're dealing with now in Washington is he calls it just pigs at the trough, both parties. that politics and political appointments to be agency heads, and it's just a trough. It's a feeding trough. It's all distributing favors and
I agree. I mean, I think of it and I'm like, how is it going to get any better? I mean, you really have to have something major happen on both sides for people to be honest and transparent.
But hang on. I mean, so that was his point. His proposal is just everyone needs to go, I mean, they're just terrible people who have set up shop in Washington. And there just needs to be some mechanism. I'm not suggesting not an unconstitutional mechanism, but some kind of a groundswell citizen movement just to say all of these people infesting Washington need to go home. They need to leave the District of Columbia.
Yes.
And, you know, they can enjoy their pensions, but just go away. But it would require so much orchestrated engagement from the citizenry. Yeah. And I don't know if we're going to be able to get there. I mean, we're all so busy, and with inflation running, you know, everybody's got to work their ass off to pay bills, and we're distracted. And so I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Term limits.
Well, as the one Megadeth song, Washington Is Next, says, keep the people poor and stupid. And,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
And then, you know, then the haves get to take from the have nots, and everybody, you know, they stay in power. Let's switch gears a little bit in the remaining time we have to your new book, which I started reading. Thank you for disturbing my sleep, because I have an awfully hard time putting it down. It reads like a thriller, because it is, but it actually happened. And, you know, the chapters are short enough. I go, okay, just one more chapter. And then it's just one more chapter. And then it's just like, oh my gosh, tomorrow's going to hurt. So tell us about The Meaning of Malice.
I love that title.
The Meaning of Malice. Here's my new book. I have worked on this book for many, many years. It's about that lady right there. Her name is Sandra Bridewell. Just to quickly jump right in, she lived down the street from me in Dallas when I was growing up. I was friends with her daughter. She had three children. I was friends with her second, her daughter. And that is Sandra on her third wedding day. And you can't see the young man. He's a 29-year-old man from Oklahoma who met Sandra the day after he moved to Dallas. They had a whirlwind romance. She told him she was pregnant. He quickly proposed marriage. They married. And then on the eve of their one-year anniversary, he was last seen as he ran out to run an errand with Sandra, never seen alive again, was found a few days later, shot to death in his vehicle. Sandra, in the year 1985, fell under suspicion quickly for murdering this man. She became the prime suspect. For reasons I go into in the book, law enforcement kind of fumbled around with this. It was a notorious case in my small affluent community in Dallas. I got very interested in this. So this was the year 1985. I had my encounters with Sandra in the years 83 and 84. So right before this action happened, I wasn't really aware of what was going on at the time. It wasn't in the press. I think my mom and her friends were gossiping about it, but I didn't really hear about it. Where I heard about it was 2 years later. D Magazine is our local glossy magazine of gossip and events in Dallas. So in May of 1987, there's this cover story. And by then, I was 16 years old. I was pretty literate. I read a lot when I was a kid. I was like, holy smokes, that's Sandra. That's Catherine's mom. I know that lady. So I read this D Magazine story with great interest. And what the D Magazine story says is, well, not only did her third husband wind up shot to death, turns out her first husband in the year 1975 was found shot to death in his marital bed in his family home. Now, the Dallas police responded to the scene, and it kind of looked like he'd committed suicide, that he'd shot himself in bed. It was quickly ruled a suicide. 7 years later, Sandra's second husband was being treated for lymphoma. And his treating physician was a local kind of star society oncologist in Dallas. He was actually my grandmother's doctor. And as Sandra's second husband lay dying, she took a fancy to the oncologist. He was a kind of a handsome, charismatic doctor with a very wealthy clientele. He had a beautiful house here in our town, a vacation home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Sandra takes a fancy to the doctor 2 months after Sandra's second husband died. The doctor's wife is found shot to death in her vehicle shortly after having given Sandra a ride to Love Field Airport, purportedly to rent a car. She, the doctor's wife, is found in the parking lot at Love Field Airport in her vehicle, shot to death. Dallas police respond, kind of they do a cursory analysis. Medical examiner again rules suicide. So what I did with this, and I started in the year 2007, Sandra was arrested in North Carolina, but not for murder. She had changed her persona from that of a sort of femme fatale seductress to that of a Christian minister and missionary. She met this old lady. She said, "I'm in between missions. I'm about to depart for a mission in Africa. In the meantime, I could stay with you, help with household chores, cooking, cleaning, etc." The old lady was delighted for the company. Sandra is a very charming lady. Sandra moved in with the old lady and then proceeded to steal her identity, to plunder her finances, to try and reroute her Social Security benefit. She got caught for that. It's multiple fraud charges, and was sentenced to 2 years in a federal penitentiary for identity theft. I began really researching this story then. I looked at it for many years, that my main focus was going back and looking at those first two gunshot deaths, the husband one and then the doctor's wife. And I was able to obtain the death scene photos from the records division. And I had very contemporary, very, very experienced forensic experts examine those photographs. And their conclusion was these were not suicides. These were homicides staged to look like suicides. So in conclusion, when I examine the whole story, the photographic evidence, all the circumstantial evidence, the witness testimony, all of this leads me, I'm not saying this is the truth of the matter, but I'm saying if you ask me, if I were a juror, I would believe when I look at all of this that Sandra, who's long been suspected, is in fact a serial killer. And she's still alive. And she's
getting out of prison soon.
No, she's already
free. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because that was like, what, 2009 or so. Oh.
So she might even watch this.
Wow. So I don't know if May should read that book if it goes into detail about faking suicides. I'm just saying.
You know, it's interesting because if you look at those photos, particularly of the first husband, you know, you realize it actually wouldn't. I mean, she didn't do it in my estimation. She didn't do it very well. The staging is actually pretty clumsy. But, you know, when I look at those photos, you know, I realize had she done just a few things just a little differently in her staging, it would have been impossible to have ascertained that this wasn't a suicide. It would have just a few modifications in her staging and how she did it, and you would not have been able to tell. But she did make some mistakes in her staging, some pretty significant ones.
So do you go in, without giving the whole book away, I mean, into the, how can there be this many, I wouldn't say bumbling errors, but what looks like, you know, if it's your theory is correct that she's responsible, when you, you know, circumstances and coincidences keep adding up, and then there's her last husband. So how do you keep saying that these experts just keep writing it off as whatever? I mean,
no experts. My experts are contemporary forensic experts that reviewed the things that were not reviewed at the time.
Yeah. Cause these are closed cases, correct?
Yeah. Like, suicide. So, the problem with a cursory analysis and a ruling of suicide is that it then absolves people of looking very closely at it. I mean, it's all a matter of how closely do you look, how much scrutiny do you bring to bear? And there was actually a police captain in New York. I think his name was Gabarrett, I think is his name, like a retired captain. And he wrote an interesting study on, it's not uncommon, or historically it's been rather common, law enforcement responds to a death scene that kind of looks like suicide. You know, guy hanging in his garage, you know, or a husband found shot to death in his bed. And it kind of looks that way. So that initial impression will oftentimes have a fatal outcome for the investigation because they think, well, it looks like suicide, so they don't look closer. And you know what I conclude in my belief is they just didn't look very closely. I mean, in the case of the first husband, the Dallas police just aren't accustomed to looking at this. It's a very affluent neighborhood. This mother with three children, she's very pretty. She's very charming. It's a beautiful house full of antiques. He was under pressure. He was a dentist. Apparently, there's statistically dentists have a higher rate of suicide. So it just kind of looks like a suicide.
But husband number three, I mean, people aren't.
Yeah, but husband number two was lymphoma. She didn't give the second husband.
No, but you know what I mean?
Lymphoma.
I'd be at my husband number three. You'd think that there'd be some.
Well, I mean, she
said, looking back, going, okay, how? I mean,
well, she is the prime. But hang on, she is the prime suspect. I mean, the cops had no question,
right,
that she murdered husband three. But I mean, and two of them have actually stated on national television, I believe she murdered Alan Rarig. So, you know, why exactly the district attorney's office didn't pursue the matter is another question, but the cops believed she murdered husband three, and they've stated that on national television. The question is, why didn't you guys go back and look at the doctor's wife and the first husband? So I did what the police didn't do. Yeah.
It reminds me of that Mike Myers, So I Married an Axe Murderer, where, you know, there's just all these questions. Well, my concern is she's become a river pilot in Baltimore.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, hey, why not? I mean, she could be a diversity hire. An elderly lady who has no, experience piloting, but maybe she knows someone. Maybe she's charmed someone. I mean, well, you just never know, right?
Yeah,
no kidding. So
exactly.
Do you ever, I'm curious now because the thing is looking at unsolved crimes and mysteries. I mean, did you ever get into the JonBenet Ramsey stuff at all and look into that?
You know, people suggested that I look into that. And I don't know, maybe it's where I was in my life. My heart just kind of sank with that case. It just looked, I don't know. No, the answer is
yes, no.
I didn't. For some reason, I wasn't. My curiosity wasn't really so much, and there was just something really so a little kid. I don't know. Sandra is a fascinating character. I mean, my hat's off to her in terms of just being a really, and I remember her perfectly. I mean, I was young. I was 13, 14 years old, but she was a beautiful, charming, charismatic woman.
Wow.
And men really found her irresistible. So I think she's a fascinating character.
Any hints on what you might be working on next or what you got your eye on other than the ship?
I've got a book coming out about the Lahaina, the incineration of mm-hmm. Lahaina. I've lived a few years in Maui. I really loved Lahaina. That's another one of these just head scratcher stories. Yeah. Because the legacy media is no longer doing investigative journalism. There's 100 stories a day, interesting intrigues that just aren't being looked at.
Exactly.
I saw an interview. Tucker Carlson is doing a great job of kind of carrying a lot of weight. And he interviewed a German doctor on Monday, German doctor, Dr. Michael Nails, N-E-H-L-S, Michael Nails. And this guy tells his theory of neuroinflammation and the effects of neuroinflammation on the entire mental and personality structure of a human being. Like this elevated cytokine inflammation in the brain, it's like early Alzheimer's disease, kind of those where there's a mental lethargy, a lack of engagement. I mean, if you're talking with someone suffering from mental lethargy, they may report it as something like brain fog. The world is just kind of fuzzy. I can't track things. I don't remember things very well. And this German doctor has just come out with a book called The Indoctrinated Brain. And he makes so many just fascinating observations that COVID, SARS-CoV-2, the virus, and the messenger RNA vaccines are very inflammatory. And the S protein can actually get into the brain. Mm-hmm. There are autopsy studies that have found the spike protein in the brain. It's crossed the blood-brain barrier. And Tucker Carlson says, my experience with COVID was it just left me feeling profoundly depressed for 2 weeks. And that really resonated with me. That was my symptom. Fatigue and mental lethargy and depression for 2 weeks. And you think of someone who keeps getting these shots that induce the spike protein in uncontrollable amounts, and then they'll get sick with COVID, and then they'll get another shot, and then they'll get sick with COVID again. This repeat exposure to this spike protein. And the way this doctor has it worked out is that's just one element in our environment now, in which individuality and individual thought is under an absolute all-out assault. And I just found his presentation, and I bought his book on Kindle. I mean, all of this will have to be evaluated, but it is the most frightening story I've ever heard told. I mean, the implications of this narrative that this man tells, it's just unfathomably terrifying to me.
Beginning of the zombie apocalypse.
Well, it is. It is. And yeah. Even if it's partially true. And then I'm sure you read Geert Van den Bosch.
Sure.
I mean, his Substack this morning was just like, oh, shit.
I saw it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole now, this is an immune escape pandemic. you know, if you're in a highly vaccinated country, you're going to just have a massive uptick of long COVID, which is kind of like almost an HIV-like syndrome, and then potentially another variant that comes where people will be just entirely defenseless, and it won't look like Omicron. They'll call it, I don't know, what is it? Virus B or whatever it is,
pandemic. Disease X.
That one, because he's been pretty much he's been like the prophet Jeremiah. That'd since
be very
the beginning
frightening as well. So we're left with dead bodies and zombies. I mean,
well, and it's interesting. He talks about there is a long line of research of different kinds of thinking that we do. And, you know, in the course of the day, you know, as we go on about our routines, you know, it's very interesting to think that routines in many ways are very comforting, very calming. And, you know, why? Because they don't require, if you get a hard routine, you know, you wake up, you brush your teeth, you drink your coffee, you look at the sun or whatever. Once that becomes a hard routine, you don't have to exert any mental energy to do it. So it's a kind of autonomous cognitive state, or maybe autonomous isn't the word, but a kind of somnambulant. You don't have to think about it. And then there's the one where it's like, okay, no, wait a minute, problem solving, engage, you know, look at data, gather data, analyze data, pay attention. What seems to be happening is that more and more people are unable to go from that just kind of somnambulant going through their routines to engaging in the world of thought. And I think it was the guy, if I remember the interview, it was one of the guys that discovered DNA. Was it Watson and Crick? One of those guys was musing about these two different kinds of thinking. Mm-hmm. And he called this one, you know, just going about your routine, he called that the zombie phase, or the zombie mode of thought. He actually called it that.
Wow.
And so it's fascinating and terrifying to think from like a science fiction kind of scenario that we're being turned into zombies. Humanity is being turned into zombies.
Well, and I mean, if this wasn't enough, right? If your phone isn't enough to zombify you.
Right.
I mean,
I was thinking about that this morning. I was just kind of laying in bed before I got up, and I was like, what would it be like if I actually just completely unplugged from electronics, even for a week, even for a day? How different would it be?
It's remarkable. I chartered a sailboat in the British Virgin Islands a few years ago now. God, COVID kind of time warped us, didn't it?
Yes.
And I turned off my phone and threw it in the chart table and did not look at it. I think I told my mother, you know, call the yacht base if there's an emergency, and they'll raise me on the VHF. I didn't look at my phone for 7 days. I didn't even look at it. I felt like 200 years younger. I felt so refreshed and invigorated. And I wondered why don't I do this all the time? But we're so addicted to our devices.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
Yeah. And you know, you need it for like,
I'd be happy to get rid of email.
Well, we're doing a podcast. We're having this conversation. I mean, this is the good side of
it's true.
Of media. You have to, you know, market it, and you know, blah, you have right. to, you have to piss people off on the CDC site. You know, like I got jobs to do, and so you know, you look at it, and it's yes, but at the same time, maybe there needs to be phone Sabbath and phone sabbaticals, and I mean. Coming from me, May's head's going to explode because I'm as addicted to it as anybody else. But I mean, that might make, I mean, think about that, right? Like we don't work outside like we used to. And maybe just, you know, you take a day off and you say, you know what? I'm going to have a phone Sabbath. Mm. How different would that make us? Just one day a week.
We should do an experiment.
I love that.
You know, now with Dr. McCullough and I working together and we talking to a lot of people and doing a lot of research, and I'm supporting Dr. McCullough and just gathering data for his medical research and so on and so forth. If I were to turn off my phone for a week, when I flipped it back on, I would have like a million.
Oh, my gosh. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. I mean, the email list would just give me a heart attack. So I don't know. I guess we're stuck with it. You know, there are these changes, and there was that film, The Magnificent Ambersons. I don't know if y'all remember that, but it takes place at the time that America is going from horse and buggy to internal combustion engine. And this one guy can't come to terms with that the world is changing. He loves horses, and he just can't imagine that these dirty mechanical machine things are going to replace the horse and buggy. But he has to come to terms with it because things change. And, you know, maybe what we're called upon is to figure out ways to incorporate new and useful things, but, you know, put it in its place and hold it in that place. Don't just let it become our master. I'm afraid that's what we've done with our devices.
I know. I've called it the Antichrist for years.
Yeah, but it's going to be interesting because nothing has been more disruptive in medical practice than the EMR. Yeah. And May and I have worked fairly closely with a couple AI companies, and that has the ability, like, we just interviewed a week or so ago one of the CEO of Lindy, which is a fascinating company. And he's like, my goal is that physicians never touch a keyboard. And if that happens, that's actually a really good use of technology because that rehumanizes our ability to connect with people. So maybe we're at the stinky, grimy car stage and not at the 70 Chevelle stage yet. You know,
right. I don't know. There you go.
Let's hope it just doesn't keep getting worse. Like, we used to think computers were going to revolutionize the world. And
no, I think, well, yeah, either that or Skynet will become autonomous, right. Self-aware, and, you know, the Terminators will come. And then we'll have the zombie apocalypse and the Terminator apocalypse at the same time.
And then they'll have the ability to shut you off at the right time.
Yes. Well, John, that was absolutely delightful. We would love to talk to you anytime you want.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, guys. Thanks so much.
That's fascinating stuff. The book sounds amazing.
It's really good.
I'm next. So thanks for joining us. And we will link your books and all the notes at the end of the show. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Thanks so much.
It's no secret that medicine is a bit uptight. That's why Tim and I created BS Free MD, to mix things up a little and have fun in the process. Besides, we are having these exact same discussions all the time, so we thought we might as well invite everyone to the party. If you really like us, you can get plenty more and maybe see one of Tim's cool tattoos on our Instagram or Facebook pages at BS Free MD. See you next time.
While we try to keep BS Free MD as raw and real as possible, we can't be held responsible for any medical decisions or discussions had as a result of what you've heard on the show. We know, bummer. But the truth is, we really do care about your questions. So feel free to reach out to us by email at doc@bsfreemd.com.